Florida Basketball, our podcast, is brought to you by the Gatorverse, an exclusive community dedicated to connecting University of Florida fans and student-athletes. Members receive access to exclusive autographed collectibles, real-life experiences, giveaways, VIP events, rewards, and athletes receive a majority of revenue from sales of their collectibles. That's the way that NIL is supposed to work. To find out more about becoming a Gatorverse member and Lockermania, visit Gatorverse.io. That's Gatorverse.io.
Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. Going to be joined by Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com in just a moment. Kind of a live show tonight. Thought that would be a fun way to kick off SEC play, especially with like the Gators opening with a rival, which is pretty dope. Honestly, like I think like this was such a made for TV thing because normally you're used to Florida being like on like rivalry. Like they used to have that rivalry week thing where it was like, hey, everybody's rival plays the first weekend of February and the last weekend of March. And so the SEC network was kind of like, you know what? Like, let's just open SEC play with a rivalry game. Like, let's just dive all in and throw it on the mothership and see what happens. So that's why you get Florida-Kentucky opening night. It's not because Florida sucks, so they have to play Kentucky first now. No, this was the total opposite when it was addressed at SEC Media Days as we're showcasing the programs that have won national championships in the SEC this century to start SEC play, and no team in the SEC has beaten Kentucky more since integration than Florida. So when you put those two things together, you kind of get why this game's opening weekend. We're going to talk a lot about it. We will talk about the Quinnipiac game a little bit too. And welcome, Eric. Happy New Year, dude.
Happy New Year. How was your holiday season?
Oh man, it was quite a shit show.
in this happy household. I asked.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. And yet also like just total mania with multiple kids running around and family. And so in a lot of ways, like I'm really glad to like be done with it. Even though I love Christmas and the holidays so much. You?
Oh yeah, mine was good. You know, no kids makes for much easier Christmas. Both me and my wife's family are close by, so not a lot of travel. It was all good, and it got kicked off kind of nicely with a special interview right before the holiday season, or right as holiday season kind of began. So I don't know if I'm allowed to say what that is or when that's going to run, but that was a good one. So. Everything was good with me. I'm excited to be watching some other leagues as they've been kicking off the last couple of days, and of course excited for SEC basketball to get going.
No, it's going to be great. And like I was just telling people listening that, you know, yeah, I mean this was purposeful. This was an intentional. Let's make sure that we showcase two big time premium programs that you know, obviously you have the blue blood Kentucky and then Florida, which has had so much success in the last, you know, 30 years. Not really blue blood status. I mean, the Tears article really hammered Florida. You know, I think you could have put Florida easily in that like second near blue blood tier and nobody would have batted an eyelid. But, you know, then again, you know, it's a point you've always made, like a lot of these kids that they're recruiting, like, man, like, if they were alive, they were in diapers when Joakim Noah and Al Horford were winning titles. And obviously Florida had a great decade in the 2010s. They won more games than any SEC program other than Kentucky. But even that scenario, you know, I mean, Florida's last Final Four, you know, a lot of these kids were 8, 9 years old at most. So it's been a little bit, and Florida's trying to avoid a third straight season without an NCAA tournament appearance, which has not happened to the Gators in 30 seasons. So figure that one out.
Yeah, that's just kind of my response to any blue blood conversation. and it's you know, it's happening with a couple of programs right now. I mean, and then it's even funny to me as well. I mean, one of the teams that would be kind of universally considered blue blood would be Indiana. Well, like, what does that mean in 2024 with these, again, these kids that haven't seen them be relevant since these guys were in elementary school. So I've just always thought that the status of these programs is a little bit more of a what have you done for me lately thing. And this whole idea of schools being cemented as blue bloods. I don't know. As you kind of alluded to, I just don't see it that way. And if people want to argue the traditional blue bloods are blue blood, like, sure. I don't really care, to be honest, but you know, I'd rather be a functional blue blood where kids want to go to and programs want to continue to, like, again, you talked about made for TV events. It's like, well, the blue bloods are still getting invitations to the biggest tournaments. They're still getting the best TV opportunities. Florida gets, you know, if you want to even look at Florida, there was, of course, they get to the PK events, which have been the biggest events every year that they've happened. But outside that, I mean, are the Gators getting invited to Maui?
Yeah.
You know, are the things like that? I don't know. So I don't know. So like, if people want to argue that Florida should be in the blue blood conversation because of what they did not that long ago with back-to-back titles, I mean, hey, absolutely. Because it wasn't just the titles. There was a lot of years on both ends of that were still, you know, Final Four, Elite Eight, caliber teams that, not just caliber that accomplished that. But again, it's like, well, what does that mean right now if a bunch of your games are, your non-conference games are on SEC Network Plus and the current kids you're recruiting don't remember those steps? So didn't know we'd start this on a blue blood conversation before, outside of non-conference play. But it's something that matters, I think, especially in the day and age where recruiting's changing more than ever, and there's more factors than ever that people are considering. There's some schools that would be traditional blue bloods that are, I think a lot of people saw UCLA and the head coach talking pretty candidly about how he didn't think that they had enough NIL support, and I think a lot of people would be like, oh, well, this is a blue blood. Well, if they're struggling to get players, like, and are outside of the tournament picture, I mean, where does that leave you? So that's just something that I constantly think of every time I hear the blue blood label, or to try to tier them. It's a tough challenge.
I it just seems like a recency bias conversation in so many ways, outside of like a handful of programs. And you just mentioned, and that handful is even somewhat volatile because like UCLA is out there talking about how they lack NIL support. Whereas like, you know, Florida has Florida Victorious now after the Gator Collective collapsed. And we will have a Tyree Samuel interview that will drop tomorrow too. So people know that we helped Florida Victorious do, and just wanted to get that out there. Just two Canadians talking hoops right before Christmas, guys. I was not a part of it, so all the more reason to listen. That was funny was like Florida Victorious is behind in football, but then when you talk to players at Florida, when you talk to players Florida's contacted in the portal, when you talk to actual people at Florida Victorious, when you talk to like basketball, and we've said this on the show a couple of times, and some people reached out and were like, huh, really? Like Florida basketball has a nice war chest. Like they're fine on NIL money, man. That is not an issue in Gainesville. We could have a whole different rabbit hole about whether or not that means that there's frustration with the high school recruiting or whatever. But I think that it's pretty clear the way Condon and Thomas Hawk have played, the way this staff wants to build their team. And that's really not a in-season podcast. It's certainly not a before the Kentucky game podcast. By the way, shout out to Gator Brent, Coach Brent dropping in to say hello. What's up, man? Good to see you. So we will start with Quinnipiac because I thought like this was the best like sleepy holiday game performance I've seen from a Florida team in a long time. I don't know how good Quinnipiac is. Like we talked about how, like they have a really good point guard who I think could play most anywhere and be pretty good, to be honest. Now, he is a point guard. He has no interest in scoring, but he's really good, I think. And but I don't know how good their team is. Florida just decimated them. Like they and what was, I think, most encouraging about it wasn't like that Florida beat them or that Florida did what they've done, you know, most of the year and dominated the rebounding battle. That wasn't actually true. Like Quinnipiac got a lot of offensive rebounds in this game. It's that Florida executed offensively. Like they passed the ball. They spaced the floor nicely. There was a lot of making the extra pass. And I'm not like, I guess the elephant in the room is that Kugel didn't start, but it was maybe the most crisp that Florida has looked offensively in the golden era. And like, I don't say that to knock Florida at all. I mean, obviously Florida was post, what's the right word, Eric? They were over 100 in KenPom offense last year. So they were pretty dire offensively a season ago, but like, this was good. I mean, they executed the stuff they ran well. Whether or not you think it's great stuff schematically, okay, whatever. It was just really impressive. Like, I came away from that being like, man, that was great. That's how you treat a game like that. If you're a coach and you weren't happy about that, I don't know. You're a different kind of coach than me.
Yeah, I think that there was kind of two takeaways from this game for me. And the first one is something that I've said before, and it just gets confirmed every time that Florida plays a bye game, is just that the style of play that the Gators have with their high possession, fast pace, like first of all, if you're playing a team that you know that you're more talented than, playing more possessions is always the way to go. So when Florida played slow under the previous coaching regime, it certainly just gave lesser talented teams an opportunity to hang in games. So, that's something that helps the Gators in these bye game scenarios. And also the fact that they just are, again, hammering teams on the offensive glass and just are able to finish everything around the rim, because everyone at the 4 and 5 spot is going to have a multi-inch advantage over anyone who's guarding them. And again, like the Bobcats were able to get a bunch of offensive rebounds. Looking back at them, there was some like favorable bounces. Like I think a lot of people were like, oh, the Gators weren't focused, they weren't trying hard. I don't know. You go back and watch some of those offensive rebounds, and like it's this game of basketball. And the Gators have had a lot of bounces go their way off the rim. This one they didn't. And I don't feel particularly like, again, we could be generally concerned about Florida's defensive rebounding because their defensive rebounding numbers aren't great, and maybe for that reason they shouldn't get the benefit of the doubt with a game like this. But I don't know. A lot of those offensive rebounds were pretty chaotic, and it just happened to fall favorably to Florida's opponent. But again, I think that I think the first takeaway is just, again, like Florida's ability to just like hammer teams that they should hammer is going to be big, because again, like, and we can talk grand takeaways from non-conference, but like I've mentioned it before, and I know this is a little bit wet blankety for some people who are really high on the Gators, what the Gators have accomplished. Like I cannot look at the way that the non-conference schedule went and say this was like a massive success for the Gators. I'm not saying it was a failure. That's certainly not the case, but I just can't look at their lack of quality wins. If I were to refresh the net, they're 48th in net right now. Like I can't look at a non-conference where the Gators come out at 48th in the net and say this was some grand success. So they have work to do. And of course they need to get quality wins for sure, but they're also going to need to avoid the bad loss, and the style of play that the Gators have shown to play will be that they can kind of avoid taking a bad loss. And I'm not saying the Gators are going to necessarily sweep the bottom third of the league, because still those teams are better than a lot of Florida's bye game opponents. But like, I have less fear of those games than maybe recent years, even as much as last year. So that just shows that there is a high floor for this team. And that was big. And then of course, I think the second takeaway has to be what you just alluded to before I started rambling was Riley Kugel not in the starting lineup. Zion Pullen comes in for him. Zion Pullen plays great. Riley Kugel comes off the bench, does not play very well. And I think that maybe even more damning for a player like Kugel is not just the fact that he didn't play well and or play great in his new role for one game. It's that Florida's offense looked way, way better with him off the floor. And that's something that the numbers are kind of bearing out. Florida's offense, I could actually probably just pull this number up quickly. So Florida has our 9 points. So with Riley Kugel on the floor, the Gators have a 117 offensive rating. With him off the floor, they have a 126 offensive rating.
Ooh.
So we can get it. I could do a whole lot of other numbers. I actually just did a Riley Kugel article at Gator Country about the struggles he's having. But for the purposes of this conversation, Florida's 9 points better offensively this season with Riley Kugel off the floor. And with the way that Zion Pullen's playing, with the way that he complements his teammates, maybe a little bit better than Kugel. I think you can look at the struggles Kugel had and the way he missed threes and extended his streak of, 0 for 18 from three over the last four games. But I think the more damning thing is it was, Florida looked a lot better offensively without him. Was their defense a little bit worse? Maybe, but it's not as stark as the difference offensively.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And that was the thing I was going to say. And then the other thing is when he did do good stuff, it was when he did the things that they want him to do when they run things for him. Right? Like he got to the free throw line, was it 6 or 8 times? So like when you are built like Riley Kugel, you're 6'5", 200. You look like you could play linebacker for Michigan. I think, and we alluded to this on the prior show, like, cause there were a lot of people that were talking about, oh man, they got to run better stuff for, and I'm like, no, they're running things for Riley Kugel. Like I talked about the jump man conversations I had and he's turning things down or not executing them or just reverting to his kind of what this year has obviously been a horrifically inefficient step back. And so it was good to see him attack, even though he did not play well. Like I was pleased with that. And the fact that when he drove, he wasn't finishing, but he got fouled and he made some free throws, which he hadn't even been doing that. So like, yeah, he went to the line 8 times, made 6 of them. And all 4 were on drives. So like, that's good. Like, and Brent says it should have happened sooner. But Todd Golden has to manage his confidence. And there's probably something to that. I'm not, at practice, I think part of the reason that it wasn't happening was because of defense. Right. And that Todd put such a huge emphasis on that. And that Riley has been really solid defensively all season with the exception of a breakdown or two. But yeah, I mean, I think, you have to look at how much more efficient Florida was offensively and how willing they were. The ball didn't get stuck, which is another thing that's been happening. Because when Riley's not doing what's being run for him, a consequence of it a lot of times has been too much dribbling and not enough movement and stagnant offense. And like Florida wastes time in possessions where they've just run their action. So to reset, you now have to either re-space or you have to set a new screen and all of that takes time. And, the consequence of that, when you've got a guy who's just heavily handling the ball, but won't attack the 10, is it really can slow your offense down and give you a very narrow window in which you can execute the offense that, you might want to run what we call a secondary offense. Cause your first play has failed. And I think, man, like, a lot of that is, it's just tough. It's tough at any level. It's tough in the NBA, but I think it's especially tough at the collegiate level. And so you saw Florida kind of freely moving the ball in this Quinnipiac game. And then the other thing, I guess the other little bullet point from the Quinnipiac game, and you're going to talk about Will Richard anytime he goes 5 for 9, but like basically since the Richmond game, he has been an all SEC player. Like, and you cannot convince me that is not a fair take. Like he has been, because, I mean, he's so good defensively, but he's also just, I mean, he's taking smart shots, not just shooting to shoot, but he's also taking volume shots, which is something we've been asking him to do for, since he got here. And then the other thing is he's showing that he will willingly attack closeouts and be a physical player who's willing to draw contact. And he's finishing at a better rate than Kugel when he does that, Eric. So, like, there's a lot there that's super positive.
Yeah, and I think that he's just he's someone who can be a play finisher, whether it's as a catch and shoot player where, again, he's someone that before the season, I said I think he should take 7 catch and shoot threes a game at least. And there was people on Gator Country who's like, Florida hasn't had someone do that since I forget who, if it was Michael Frazier or whatever, and kind of suggested it was unrealistic. And there was this like, man, that's sad that people – yep. Like that's how little Florida has ran for shooters or had shooters over the last few games. And right. Again, you look at the last games for Will Richard, it's 5 for 9 from 3, 5 for 9 from 3. Then he was 2 for 8. But again, that was against Michigan where I thought he took 8 good attempts. And I think that's just the thing is he doesn't take a lot of threes off the dribble. They're almost always off the catch. And he's someone yeah. who I think that when he gets those looks off the catch balanced with this shoulder square to the rim, like I think everyone is pretty happy when he takes those attempts. And again, it's just like when you look at Florida's top lineups, he's in pretty much all of them. When you look at a lot of efficiency metrics, he's at the top of them because again, he doesn't force a lot of things. It's not like he's someone who isolates or runs bigger. Like he picks his spots. And again, I think there's going to be times where you see quiet games from him because he doesn't force anything, but it's one of those things. It's like when the ball is moving for Florida, the beneficiary is like the canary in the coal mine, or I guess that's only a negative thing. The like indicator of success is when Will Richard is getting points because it means that Florida is creating wide open shots. And yeah. again, like not to just pile on Riley Kugel, but you mentioned it, like when the ball is sticking, like Florida ran the dribble handoff into a ball screen that they keep doing for him on the side that he never wants to get downhill on. And it was like, He rescreened and he asked for the rescreen and he just kept moving side yeah. to side, hiding behind the screen because all he wanted to do was to get to a pull up. Like, well, one, that it wasn't a great look, and two, it didn't allow his kind of athleticism to shine because you need people to be using an explosive first step to get downhill. But the other thing too is just like, well, if he's just going to try to hide behind ball screens and pull up dribble jump shots, it's like, well, that's not really helping the players around him other than Micah Hanlockton and Tyree Samuel getting on the offensive glass. So, which they can do on other kinds of plays. So, I think that, right. I do think that like, you can just kind of look at Zion Pullen playing a great game, Florida's offense looking good and Will Richard looking really good. Like, I feel like these are all kind of interconnected. And I think going into a huge game against a very good Kentucky team, I don't even think there's a question of who's going to start. I mean, we'll see, yeah. but I think you've got to go back to pull it in there.
Yeah, no, I think they're going to have to. I thought Zion Pullen with the plus 27 in 20 minutes was my favorite stat of that game. He's the guy is just, he's been a plus minus machine. Pretty much since he came back from the suspension. And I don't mean that to take away from Tyree Samuel getting over the 1,000 point barrier in his career. That's a huge accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And doing it with a double-double, again, I think his 5th or 6th of the season. Good for him. Spencer Bissig dropped in to drop some cats on us, some Big Blue Nation in our chat. Florida's, you referenced it the off season, and that was kind of going to be my question was like, if you had to letter grade this non-conference, not off season, this non-conference schedule, what would your letter grade be? And like, mine would be B, and it could have been worse, right? Like they did pull that Michigan game out and man, did they need that one. And they won a game against Pitt, which is going to teeter in between Q1 and Q2, I think all year. I think the last time the net updated, it was still a quad 1 win. But who knows if it is, they just lost to North Carolina on their home floor. So that probably doesn't hurt them, but it certainly was a missed opportunity to help Florida a little bit. Like Florida had kind of a disastrous day or weekend from a resume standpoint after beating, like they handled all their business, which is all you have to concern yourself with. But like Florida State lost to Lipscomb, like Pitt has lost 2 in a row in like league play. Virginia got waxed by Notre Dame, which made zero sense to me. But shout out Eric Fawcett for like seeing that this kinds of games might happen to Virginia, and me just like Tony Bennett fanboying, like willfully denying that that was even possible. I kind of hid in the hole for a little while after that L. And then I think, what was the other one? Oh, McNeese. McNeese,
yeah,
with a strong ass dub over Michigan at the Chrysler Center. So, yeah, man, like that's a rough resume day, which really does magnify like this start SEC play that Florida has, right? Like, man, the Gators need some dubs.
Yeah, like the only good thing for the Gators is Wake Forest looks really good. Both because I think they are good, yeah, and also because they got the Efton Reed. So like you're just seeing that, yeah, they're just like climbing in the metrics.
And Monsanto next week.
Oh yeah, and that'll be another boost. Yeah. So that one's looking good. But like again, I'm not trying to just continue to like I'm not just trying to continue to trash Florida's non-conference performance because it was okay. But even for you to give them a B, like in my opinion, this is a little bit like, and I'm going to get way out of my depth here, but like, it's like in like figure skating or like diving where athletes like say what they're about to attempt. And then there's like a difficulty. And like, even if they nail it, but they don't do a high level of difficulty, that the best they can get is a certain score. Like with the non-conference Florida put together, like, they would for sure have to win every single game to get an A+ and
right,
maybe even an A, because it's not like it's not like there was a ton of marquee wins out there. And yeah, then, you know, Florida was just okay. And again, I just keep coming out like the name of the game should really be what is your net coming out of non-conference play? Because the quads are not super favorable to the Gators either. And it's like, yeah, they're 48th in the net. So like, I'd be more like a C.
Yeah.
Like maybe I could go to C+, but yeah, I think it was okay. But I think that the Gators knew that the SEC was going to be loaded with opportunities, which it will be. And they just, you know, chose not to challenge themselves a ton. That strategy could absolutely pay off for them. It's not inherently bad, but again, you would still like to have seen the Gators handle themselves in a way that didn't put themselves 48th in the net, going right into SEC play. But yeah, it's, I think you can be encouraged by what the Gators did to rattle off a bunch of wins in December. Feel really good going into Kentucky. Is Michigan worse than we thought? And should the Gators have handled that game in an easier fashion than they did? Possibly to probably. But hey, they also were able to get like an emotional win. And I don't think the players care about what the net is of Michigan. They know that they wanted an emotional double overtime game, and hey, that's valuable.
Yeah.
More than the numbers, perhaps, when you're just looking to see how this team is going to compete. And yeah, I think if there's any, you know, any questions about what the Gators kind of are, I think at least at the start of SEC play, it's like, well, it's not like you're starting with the team at the bottom of the league. You're taking on Kentucky, who has been, a pleasant surprise. I think everyone kind of came in with a little bit of skepticism given the last couple of years and the way that they have not reached expectations. But yeah, you see what they've done so far, and they look like a scary opponent for the Gators.
Yeah, I mean, look at Florida's first six SEC games, and it's quad one, quad two Arkansas, quad one at Tennessee, quad two at Missouri, because they are struggle bussing, and then quad one Miss State. I mean, like, and as Eric mentioned, like, I think a couple podcasts ago, like, Florida's quad one opportunities are kind of front loaded, honestly, in the SEC schedule. So like, it's good that you're coming in off an undefeated December and full of confidence. But you know, how quickly would that go away if you get run out of your own gym on Saturday by Kentucky? So two things about Kentucky, because first, I totally agree with Eric, like really pleasant surprise. And we can get into offense and what they've changed, and we will, I want to. I want to make my 2 points first. And then my second point is first true road game, really. So like, as good as it's been, and that's not, I don't think I'm knocking Kentucky like by saying that, like, you know, first big time road game that they've played. I know they played at the KFC Yum Center. I also know that the Kentucky fans dropping in right now to listen live on the internet are not going to get in the comments and lie about Louisville. So, like, this is their first road game in an environment that will be electric and hostile, because Louisville had no chance of winning that game. So what have they changed offensively, Eric? What have you seen? And why is it working? Let's just start there.
Yeah, I think the Calipari, or I don't know if it's him or someone on his staff, he'll make it sound like it's him, but they've certainly modernized with their approach to shooting. Like, there was one very funny press conference earlier in the season where Calipari was like, oh, and like, we've learned that, you know what, like in the modern age, you need to have shooters out there and you need to be able to space the floor. And like, he made it sound like he just discovered this, like, this season. And like, not that, like, it's just been like the trend of all basketball over the last 15 years. So
in moment.
Yeah. So this is a great discovery for John Calipari that he came to that shooting is important. You know, we can laugh at it, and I already just did, but I think that it's certainly something that has helped the Wildcats greatly to put a ton of shooting on the floor. And instead of all these actions where they constantly have big men ducking in and taking away driving lanes and not having players space to the slots, they've started to spread things out. To get a lot of guys coming off wide pin downs, and like these pin downs that used to be for guys curling towards the rim are now to get like an Antonio Reeves or Rob Dillingham open threes. So they're getting a lot more action off of pin downs. They're getting a lot of action for shooters coming off dribble handoffs. And you're now seeing a situation where they are third in the country in 3-point percentage. Last year they were in the 300s. I don't have it in front of me. And I think even too, they were taking a lot more threes to start the season. They kind of settled into being like middle of the pack nationally. So they're not like taking as many threes as they were earlier. But again, usually they're in like the 270s or below in 3-point attempts. It was just not anything they valued. And instead they're running a lot to generate threes. You can see with their baseline out of bounds plays, it's always looking for 3-point shooters. So just definitely a very different approach. And honestly, like I really do think you watch Kentucky and they just like look different. And of course, one of the big stories is the play of freshman Reed Shepherd. For people who don't know or have heard his name and didn't realize this, I mean, he was like the 79th ranked player in the class. And I remember when he committed, there was a lot of people that said, hey, why is this guy committing to Kentucky? He's not going to play. And you can look in the past, guys that aren't top 25 guys that go to Kentucky, they don't play as freshmen and then they transfer. So everyone's just like, what's he going to, like, why is this guy coming to Kentucky? He's just going to transfer. And a lot of people, like Kentucky fans, said like, hey, why did you take this 6'3" unathletic guy? Like, we're Kentucky, we get NBA players. And so they get this Reed Shepherd, who is extremely intelligent on both sides of the floor, can handle it, make high level passing reads. He can shoot it coming off down screens. Like, he just, like, again, I will say, doesn't look like a prototypical Kentucky player, but I mean it in a very positive sense. He's not just athleticism and size. He's incredibly high IQ, incredibly smart, making great reads. And I think that, well, Kentucky did not challenge themselves like they normally do in the non-conference. That's another major change that Calipari did. He said, hey, and you know, we're coming off a couple of years of disappointing in postseason play. Let's get some confidence in non-conference. They didn't play as many challenging games as normal, but they were able to have a good record because of it, putting up a bunch of wins and also just knocking down a ton of shots. And I think it is a much more confident offensive team than we're used to seeing from the Wildcats.
Yeah, they are much more confident. And I love that you mentioned two guys whose games I really love, Shepherd and Dillingham. Shepherd also has been really integral to their transition numbers being so much better than they have been in the last couple of seasons. So I think, like, you're seeing a team that can also and you know, that's the thing. Like, they were fine, like, running up and down with North Carolina and the kind of, like, two teams that look totally different this year, even though, like, Carolina has almost all the same pieces. They just kind of added Harrison Ingram and Cormac Ryan, who doesn't really fit, like, anything that you'd think they'd want to do, but it's working. I guess he fits spacing the floor. But like, you know, anyway, that was a great basketball game, the UNC Kentucky game. And like Kentucky just murdered them in transition. And that's how they were able to build a nice lead. And then, and Shepherd with 33 steals on the young season. That's pretty impressive. And then Dillingham, you mentioned, like, he's so interesting to me because he's like not really like the prototypical, like just freakish athlete guard that like Calipari signs. Like, I'm not knocking Dillingham athletically, right? Like, I think, like, certainly he's athletic. He's just not huge. And he's not like somebody who's going to just wow you with measurables. But one thing that he does do really well is like drive, change speeds. And, you know, he's not been bothered by smaller guards when people have tried to guard him that way. The team that guarded him best, ironically, was, and you mentioned them not challenging themselves, was UNC Wilmington. And they put a couple big guards on him, Nick Farrar and Malik Harden-Hayes, pretty consistently throughout the game. And those two guys who are 6'6 and 6'7, you know, had a little more success kind of getting out on him and defending him. And he went 1 for 9 from the floor. And like, it seems like sort of a Zion Pullen assignment is kind of what I'm getting at, because like, I think he will eat if they can get him into switches or matchups where it's Walter Clayton or somebody that's smaller for Florida. He's just been fine because he's so good at changing speeds and he's such a good ball handler. And then obviously he has that nasty quick release too on his jump shot, which I think is better than anybody at Kentucky thought it was. So maybe not, maybe their evaluations were totally spot on and this is what they expected from Rob Dillingham. But you know, if that's the case, then surely Donovan is wrong. And we know that doesn't happen very often.
No, Truly's never wrong. And I think that something that's like been interesting as well has been Antonio Reeves just being just an outrageous shooter at 56% and at such a heavy volume. And that was someone who I feel like,
yeah, totally.
There was just a couple waves last year. So, you know, he transfers last year from Illinois State to Kentucky. And I think that he was not often a super popular player with Big Blue Nation. I don't know if Spencer, Kentucky fan in the chat is still here. I'd be interested in his takes, but I don't think Reeves was often the most loved player there. His shooting was fairly erratic, but this year he's just been on a steady heater. So I think that's like pretty impressive. And I think that again, when you look last year, he was very streaky. And I think a lot of it was because he was like, well, I'm a shooter and I got to get shots up. But Kentucky's offense was not really suited to getting him open looks. And I think that it made him force a lot of bad looks. And this year, I feel like everything's coming in rhythm. And I feel like, again, when you have him at 56%, which again, it's like, I don't think that number is going to hold the whole season, but it's pretty incredible right now. And Dillingham and Shepherd, like all those guys are like 56, 48 and 46% from three. And then Trey Mitchell in the front court is a 38 or 39% 3-point shooter. And like, they're just so hard to guard. And I think again, going to how different they look, something that's pretty crazy. And I'm going to say this number and it's like, it deserves a massive asterisk. And I'll tell you why in a second, but you know, everyone knows Kentucky is always just dominant on the offensive glass. Again, we talked about it earlier. Usually they don't shoot a lot of threes. They don't hit a very good percentage of them, but they always just hammer teams on the offensive glass. And they've had some pretty legendary offensive rebounding performances against the Gators. But, you know, 3 years ago in 2021, they're 41st in the country in offensive rebounding. 2022, they were fourth in offensive rebounding. And then last year, they were first in the country in offensive rebounding. And this year, they are 231st. And 121st in defensive rebounding. So they have not been very good on the offensive glass. And again, let's remember that those are not adjusted numbers for quality of competition. They're just raw numbers. And Kentucky did not play a particularly challenging non-conference schedule. So again, it's just like everything that we have like known about Kentucky in recent years, they just look a lot different. So the reason I say there should be an asterisk is because they were/are kind of they were dealing with injuries and eligibility issues with their front court. So they just finally got 7 foot one Aaron Bradshaw into the lineup. So he's a freshman, but he's 7 foot one and 225 pounds. And then Ngannou Nyensu, who did play a little bit last year, but you know, he's 7 foot, 250 pounds. Like, those are two massive bodies that were not there until three or four games ago. And so that meant it was like 6 foot nine, 220 Trey Mitchell, playing a lot of the five, or like even 6 foot eight Justin Edwards at times. Like, they were awfully undersized due to injuries and eligibility. And again, I don't even know where they've got their international bigs. They're waiting to get eligible. That could happen before Saturday. I have no idea. But even now, at least they do have 2 7 footers that are into the lineup. And again, Bradshaw hasn't been I mean, he's a very talented freshman, but he was a freshman that came in the late stages of non-conference play. So I don't think he is a finished product. What will he be on Saturday? Unsure, but if nothing else, he's a massive body who plays with physicality, and at least Kentucky does have at least some bodies to kind of bang with the Gators. And I don't think they've got the same level of depth that Florida has up there, but certainly pedigree and Trey Mitchell, who I would say is more of a, more of a four, if you had to say whatever, but talking about positions is always difficult these days, but you know, very, very skilled offensive player, best on the perimeter. Again, like I mentioned, shooting 38% from three. He's always been a consistent shooter throughout his career. And it's like, you're used to seeing Kentucky and thinking that the strength is all in the front court with these like physical post-up players and offensive rebounders. I really like Trey Mitchell as someone who can handle the ball at the four and shoot, but like the centers don't give you much offensively, and there's not the same depth up there. So that's an area the Gators could potentially have an advantage.
Yeah, I think they could. I think especially with like Tyrese Samuel and his just having the monster senior year against those younger guys is probably and you know, people might point to like Baycott really struggling against Kentucky, to which I would say that the Tyrese Samuel and Armando Baycott athleticism comparison is not one. You know, I mean, I love Mondo, don't get me wrong, but like the man is a stuck in concrete, more or less. Like, there's a reason he's playing a super senior year and not on draft boards. And I'm not saying that Tyrese is like on a lot of draft boards, but like, you just can't really compare them athletically. I think Tyrese is quicker and has more spring and just definitely a better athlete, and will present more problems for Adu Thoreau, who's another guy that they play down there some, bang a little bit, more kind of an outside guy, but a guy that they can play at the three or the four. And then, you know, with Ahmad Bradshaw, who has, you know, he's showing glimpses for sure. What's wild about this is like they have, well, it depends on which mock you look at. Right now they have like three lottery picks in the Athletic mock. With like Justin Edwards, who was a consensus top five pick, like falling out now. So like, but Reed Sheppard entering as like a lottery pick, which no one would have predicted at the beginning of the year. And then DJ Wagner, who hasn't really played that well and who we haven't even talked about yet. Although he was massive in the UNC game, right? As like another guy that can contribute and is a bigger guard. And it will be interesting to see like if DJ Wagner flourishes just a little bit more in like SEC play than Reed Sheppard. Like, if I were an NBA scout, like, I'd be really salivating to see Reed Sheppard once he gets into SEC play, given the schedule that Kentucky has played, because he is smaller and like you could see him kind of getting swallowed up in the paint in some of these SEC games, and some of the things that he does being a little more difficult against higher athletic kind of competition. But and that's interesting, and it's weird to be able to talk about Florida as like a team who will like roll out onto the floor on Saturday and be arguably as athletic as Kentucky is, right? Like, that's not a usual thing around here in these parts, in the Miguel Blanco era. So we will see. But I do think Florida has a front court edge. I think one of the biggest tests, Eric, is this, like, is Florida's perimeter defense bad? Is it good? is it just kind of okay? Like the numbers say one thing. Some of your like deep data dives were a little bit, okay, everybody get off the ledge just a little bit, but Kentucky shoots 41% beyond the arc. I mean, you made fun of it and we all should a little bit, like John Calipari realizing that shooters help in basketball is maybe the most swaggy cow thing ever, right? Like, and then acting like he thought of it is like such swaggy cow. But, you know, like to me, like the recipe for a Kentucky blowout is Florida's perimeter defense turns out to just be bad.
Yeah, and it's like, so I appreciate you referencing something I brought up in an article a little while ago and on the podcast, just about like how I do think Florida has gotten fairly unlucky with their three-point defense. They're not allowing a lot of three-point attempts, and they are contesting a lot of them, and teams are hitting well above the national average on contested catch-and-shoot jumpers. And to me, it's like, as a defense, first thing you do is try to take away three-point attempts, and second of all, if you're going to allow them, you want to contest them. It's like, well, Florida's doing a good job of both those things. And at some point, it's got to be like, well, if teams are hitting contested threes, like you might just have to live with it because, hey, if you're going to contest a three closely, that's about, and if you're going to take away a lot of attempts, and when teams do get up attempts, they're contested. I mean, there's not a lot more you can really ask for. So again, it is interesting to see that Kentucky has really dipped in terms of their 3-point rate. They were taking a ton early and hitting a ton of them. Now they're taking an average amount and hitting a ton of them. So their percentages have been stable, but the number has gone down. So I could see a situation where the Gators don't allow a lot of 3-point shots. It just could be a situation of like, well, Kentucky might just make 40% plus of them because that's what they've been doing this year. And I think too, it's the fact that like, I would say they have four well above average 3-point shooters. That's just one of those things that it's like Florida probably like it would be somewhat unrealistic to
totally
say like, hey, if Florida doesn't shut down three of four or four of these guys, that all of them, that it was, you know, a poor performance. And I already, it's again, it's kind of funny. I'm already seeing on Twitter people being like, oh, Florida's. And again, like the narratives are always going to be louder than stats. But I know there's a lot of people that because Florida has given up a high 3-point percentage, people are like, oh, Florida's defense, 3-point defense is so bad.
Yeah.
This is going to suck because Florida's going to, like, they're going to play Kentucky and Kentucky's going to hit a million threes. And it's like, well, like the numbers like would suggest that I don't think that's going to happen.
Right.
Again, could Kentucky go 7 of 16? Like, absolutely. Like that's totally what they could do. But I think for this game, it's more like Florida's playing a team that hasn't been good on the glass. They need to control it. Florida's playing a team that again, like doesn't have the same kind of downhill athleticism that Kentucky normally has. So, I would like to see if a player does get downhill, and it's again, I think Reed Sheppard's really talented, but I'll just use him as an example. It's like, well, if he's getting downhill and you see Dillingham and Antonio Reeves and Trey Mitchell on the perimeter, it's like, well, maybe challenge Reed Sheppard to finish against length at the rim and not over rotate
totally
over help. Or if it's Antonio Reeves coming off a pin down, maybe top blocking him and making him cut back door. And if he catches that ball, make him try to finish around Micah Hamilton or Tyree Samuel or Alex Scott. Like, yeah, I think the Gators can be a little bit, I think that they should just try to not overreact a ton necessarily. Try to dominate. Okay, we're not going to allow a whole bunch of the rim. Kentucky has had post-up threats every single year for a lot of years in a row. They don't really have a post-up threat right now. So I would just see if on the Gators, it's like, hey, could we make them try to post up one-on-one as much as possible, and we'll defend it one-on-one and not allow them to turn it into catch and shoot threes. Like, I'm just not awfully concerned about the 3-point defense so long as the Gators play a tight game elsewhere. And honestly, I think if they start to overreact to the things that they shouldn't, then things will start to snowball, because that's when they'll start to give up threes if they're double teaming on post players who aren't a threat, or they over help on drives from Antonio Reeves, who's not a great finisher. You just don't want to turn these less threatening actions into wide open threes or semi open threes, because yeah, Kentucky can really hit those.
Yeah. And you know what, like another thing I wanted to point out was, And it's not a knock. I mean, obviously Kentucky has great shooters. Like, I don't think that, I mean, I think DJ Wagner can shoot the ball because I watched him play before he got to Kentucky. Like, I think he can shoot the ball better than the 30% he's shooting right now or whatever, 12 for 40. You know, I think he's better than that. But I would also say that, like, so against North Carolina, they shot 33% from beyond the arc. Against Kansas, they shot 32% from beyond the arc. The only game against an NCAA tournament team, depending on what you think of UNC Wilmington, and I'll give you that number in a second, where they shot over 33% from beyond the arc was the Miami game where Reed Sheppard just went ballistic. And, you know, that's home at Rupp Arena. So they were 9 of 21 in that game. Now, if you think that UNC Wilmington is an NCAA tournament team, then that statistic also helps me because they were 5 of 17 from beyond the arc in that game. So they do have, against teams that are going to play in the NCAA tournament, they have not shot the ball particularly well from deep yet. It doesn't mean that they can't go down to Gainesville and shoot the lights out of the basket. That's obviously very possible. And, you know, if they do, tip your hat and move on. But I think I think that you could expect some sort of dip if Florida's defending the arc pretty well. And then it's up to the Gators to control what they can control the ways that they play, which, you know, as Eric said, get your offensive rebounds. And then for me, like, Florida's big bugaboo really against some of the higher level teams they played has just been, you know, turnovers and not of the dead ball variety, these live ball turnovers that lead to baskets.
Yeah. And I think that that was something that the Golden is referenced regarding Riley Kugel's game, about that his turnovers when he was starting, and then kind of applauded him for being lower turnover against Quinnipiac. So it's certainly something that is important to Golden. And it's also just one of those things that, like, I don't even know the numbers. I'll look at it quickly right now, but a player that I think has been probably the worst with turnovers has been Walter Clayton. I see that he is 21.5% turnover rate. So that is not very good. The only players worse than him are Alex Condon and, of course, Riley Kugel. So, but it just seems like not only are they, but those are all turnovers, like you mentioned, and it seems like Walter Clayton just commits more live ball turnovers and more just puzzling ones. So those are ones that, like, you know, you turn those over against Quinnipiac and, like, oh, you probably get back and, you know, like, Alex Condon's going to chase down LeBron, block someone, and it's all good. It's like, well, those are going to be definitely points against Kentucky. The one thing that is consistent with Kentucky this year is that they still do play very fast, which is actually a little bit surprising to me, just in the sense that, I just don't think their athleticism and guys that are comfortable running the floor, it feels like there's less of those guys, but hey, they're still playing fast and having success there. DJ Wagner certainly contributing in that area. That's going to be one of those things too, that, you know, can you slow Kentucky down as well, even with offensive rebounding, make it difficult for Kentucky to secure the defensive rebound, and then they can't play as fast.
Yeah.
Again, you've mentioned all these things that make this matchup look a little different. It's like, well, Florida put zero pressure on the offensive glass outside of Colin Castleton the last couple of years. And then again, teams were just, you know, turning up field and pushing. So, I think that could hopefully be a way to slow down Kentucky a little bit. And the fact that Kentucky has it'll be very interesting, just the fact that Kentucky has not been very good on the offensive glass. But Florida has not been particularly good on the defensive glass. So, again, I think, like I mentioned, it was two things on what I just said. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, Kentucky was playing pretty undersized early. And also, I'll say, as much as I have continued to reference that the Gators haven't been very good on the defensive glass, they actually have been very good in recent games and have actually climbed up to 117th in the country in defensive rebounding rate. Of course, on the backs of playing some bye games, but hey, still it's a market improvement. So maybe the Gators are getting better on the defensive glass, and you'd think so, just given their size and the rebounding on the other end. But I think maybe just the last thing I'm thinking about with Kentucky is going back to what you said about Florida's perimeter defense, is it's one of those things that, like, you look at Florida's individual players, and I think you say, like, you know, if you asked, if you polled people just kind of generally, oh, is Walter Clayton a good defender? People would say, like, oh, I think so. Is Will Richard a good defender? Oh, yeah, he's a great defender. Is Riley Kugel a good defender? Oh, yeah, he's been a great defender. Is Zion Pullen a good defender? Like, yeah, he's a good defender. Tyree Samuel, Micah Handlocked, and Alex Conan. People would be like, yeah, those guys are good defenders. And, like, at some point, it's got to be like, well, how can these guys all be good defenders if Florida has not defended well as a team and are currently 57th in the country in adjusted defensive efficiency? Yeah. Like at some point, that's just what's interesting to me about that. And again, yeah, it's given Florida's the teams Florida has played. It's a little tough to say, but I think we'll find out pretty quickly. Okay. Like what's really going on here? I mentioned earlier that I think the Florida has bad luck when it comes to opponent 3-point shooting. So, hey, right there, maybe Florida should be a few spots better just because they've dropped a couple because of their poor luck when it comes to opponent. Well, still, even if they're a few spots better, that's like 50th. That's probably not where the staff wants to be. And relative to the level of talent defensively that we think this team has, it's a little bit puzzling. So again, I'm not asking you now, Neil, to say like, oh, well, yeah, which defenders do you think are weak? Because like, clearly there's got to be someone or some guys, but yeah, at some point we've got to be like, hey, it looks like a lot of guys can defend on this team. Like, what's going on?
Totally. No, I think that's very fair. And you know what? You mentioned something earlier that I thought was super interesting. And it was just, you know, they aren't as explosive north, south as they have been Kentucky. Like, they really do rely on these shooters and sort of better spacing and the way that they've been able to do that without being drive and kick, which was Kentucky forever and ever. Amen. And, you know, like I said, I mean, Dillingham can do it a little bit because he's so good at changing speeds with the ball, but like Reed Shepherd has had some trouble when he's gotten into the lane. They've gotten almost nothing from Justin Edwards. His minutes keep decreasing and decreasing. I'm sure they'll put him on the floor because when you have a talent that, what's the right word? I don't know. When you have a talent that bright, you just kind of keep rolling it out there to see if this is the game. And, you know, if it's the Justin Edwards game, Florida probably loses. You know, that's probably fair to say. But I do think, like, so Florida, you know, I'm not saying they can cheat, but I like your characterization of it. Like, just challenge people to finish and be responsible defensively, and then, you know, see if you can control the gas. The Gators are unbeaten at home. They've been much, much better on both sides of the ball in home games so far this year. So hopefully that continues. The building should be totally electric. Bart Torvik has it as a toss-up. They have Florida winning. KenPom basically has it a toss-up. They have Kentucky winning. Obviously, it would be a huge win for Florida. I mean, Todd Golden has one top 10 win in Gainesville. I think Tennessee was what, number one or number two? I think they were number two. And so, yeah, they were number two. So that was his top 10 win. But, you know, only Kentucky has more top 10 wins in the last 10 years than Florida basketball. So that's the entire white era. And then a year of Golden. So Florida can add another one to that ledger. It would also be the one or the first win that, you know, like at the end of the year will safely be a quad one win, regardless of like whatever happens. So I think, you know, obviously huge stakes from that standpoint too, Eric.
Yeah. And I think, again, the vibes are pretty good among Florida fans. There's a lot of believers in this team. And again, despite, you know, losers like me that keep trying to throw cold water on the non-conference schedule, like, people are still super excited about what this team is. And when teams are saying like, hey, I know Florida doesn't have, or when fans are like, hey, I know this team doesn't really have any good wins, but hey, I love how hard they play and how fast they play and how talented they look. Like, well, then you add that in with a win over Kentucky to start the SEC play. Like, that'd be pretty huge. And we saw that the players came out with good energy after the holiday season against Quinnipiac. So I'm sure they're going to be pretty fired up to play Kentucky. So yeah, pretty huge one from like the general momentum of the season standpoint. certainly we're a month and a half away from must win territory. So it's not anything like that, but it's certainly, it's, if they were to win, would be huge for momentum. huge for the mindset of these players. And you know that fans would be rocking. And I know a lot of people as well who this matters to have been saying, like, hey, when are the Gators going to start getting AP poll votes? And I was kind of like, well, kind of would agree with voters for not really stuffing them right now, but you beat Kentucky. You could certainly find the Gators with the number next to their name, which is, you know, I really, not that it matters for NCAA tournament resume or anything like that, but I think it certainly matters in terms of perception and everything like that. So,
100%.
That's pretty big.
100%. And like, it wouldn't happen overnight, but you know, talk about teams without a lot of good wins. Like, they got Ole Miss and Oxford right after this. So, you know, Ole Miss is unbeaten. They're going to lose to Tennessee in Knoxville on Saturday, so they won't be unbeaten when they play Florida, but they'll still be 13-1. And like, it's going to be a quad one game. Like, you go back to back wins over Kentucky and Ole Miss start league play. Well, then you're going to get people's attention. So like, Florida has these opportunities ahead of them. It is a little bit front loaded, to be quite honest, people. Especially because like, Florida's return trip to Rupp is January 31st. So like, after that, like, you look at Florida's schedule and there's like kind of a dearth of opportunities to get wins after Texas A&M and Auburn. We mentioned that stretch on the Over Under show where they go at Kentucky, Texas A&M, Auburn, like super fun. But then like, the back half of Florida's SEC schedule is like not a ton of resume opportunities. So like, get them now, get them early, especially Kentucky, like young team, even with Antonio Reeves, still young, first road game. Like, yes, there's always Kentucky fans everywhere, but like, take them out of the game, see if you can grab yourself a dub. I'll let Eric sign us off.
Go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.